My mom also told me to keep an eye on Cutter at all times, and I didn't do that. So maybe I deserved whatever happened to me at a stranger's house. But when we got there, nothing terrible happened. The old lady, who told me to call her Zell, made me a glass of Coke in a bright turquoise metal cup that turned as cold as the ice she put in it. My throat was so tight I couldn't swallow the Coke, so I just held the cup in my hand until it got too cold to stand. Then I put it on the coffee table and watched the condensation drip down the sides while the old lady, Zell, went to find me a coaster. Her house was nice, cozy, the kind of house you'd see on a TV show. Zell also seemed like she could be on a TV show, playing the plump neighbor who's nice but kind of obnoxious, the one you just have to love because she means well. She stared at me while I took a polite sip of that Coke, and that's what I told myself. She means well. She'd brought me there, hadn't she? She'd taken me in when she didn't have to. The whole lot of them could have left me there, crying and wailing like I was, all of them hoping I'd get myself together and get myself home eventually. But they didn't leave me. They huddled like a football team made a decision. Maybe they drew straws and Zell got the short one. But however they made it, she was the one elected. She told me I was going home with her, as if it were the best news she'd ever heard. And when we left, the other people walked out with us, each of them promising to check in on me later, like they actually cared. Alec and Lila's dad said, "Feel better," and looked really sad. And I wished I had a dad like him. I knew they didn't have a mom, but sometimes I thought a dad would be better anyway. I mean, if you had to pick just one. As I drifted off to sleep on Zell's couch underneath the afghan she put over me when I couldn't stop shivering, I thought about the sign at the pool's entrance that said, "We're all family here." Maybe, I decided, it wasn't a lie. Everett. Jency Cabot was sitting at his kitchen table, looking for all the world like she belonged there. Like she'd just been by last week to drop off some blueberries she'd picked and was back to eat the muffins Bright made from them, or whatever women did with one another when he was at work. He tried not to stare at her, taking in the changes that had occurred since the last time he'd seen her, which wasn't nearly as long ago as Bright thought. He couldn't let on about that. So far, Jency was doing a good job of pretending it had never happened. Was it possible she'd forgotten? His gaze flickered back over her. Damn, but she was still beautiful. Whether her hair was still the same color blonde as it had been in high school, or she'd had some help keeping it that color, didn't matter. Except for the faintest lines around her eyes, and a bit more wisdom in them, she looked just like the girl he loved first. He forced himself to look away and smile at Bright, who was all revved up about what had happened at the pool that day. She'd talked of nearly nothing else. "So then what happened?" he asked, feigning the same level of interest when all he wanted to do was grill Jency about what she was doing back in town and ask her if she was mad at him. She had a right to be. "Well, they took him in the ambulance, but the saddest part..." Bright and Jency exchanged mournful glances. "The saddest part was his older sister. They didn't take her with them, and it just broke her heart. So she's fallen apart, and we're all just standing there wondering what to do." Bright looked at Jency again, and he could see the faintest bit of that old hero worship in her eyes as she did. Jency was really great with her. Jency shrugged. "She's close in age to my daughters. I just talk to her the way I do with them when there's a crisis." "Have you had lots of crises in your life?" He refrained from speaking the words aloud. He liked to think her life in Connecticut had been good, better than the one she'd left behind, the one that had once included him. "Well, you got her calmed down." Bright stood and began clearing the plates from dinner, shooing Jency back into her place when she attempted to stand as well. "I was useless." Everett didn't like the tone this conversation was taking. His wife was regressing in front of his eyes. Where was the confident, capable woman she'd become in her 20s, sans Jency? He wasn't sure that Jency's reappearance in their lives, right on the heels of the infertility issues, was the best thing. He'd been close to talking her into subjecting themselves to all of it again, shoring her up for battle. He couldn't afford for Jency to reduce her to that uncertain girl she'd been back when they were in high school. That girl could never have gone through all that his wife, grown up, confident, bright, had. "I'm sure you weren't useless, honey," he spoke up. He saw Jency's eyes cut over to him and away in a flash. So she didn't like him calling Bright honey. Interesting. Or maybe he was just reading too much into the situation. Projecting. Isn't that what Bright called it when he said things he wished were true as if they already were? Did he want Jency to be bothered? To be jealous? Yes, he did. God help him. He did want Jency to eat her heart out over how it had all turned out. Never mind the way things had gone down that last time. Never mind that things might have been different.
"Everett," Brad asked, "would you mind getting Christopher out of his seat?"
Without waiting for his reply, Bright handed him a wet washcloth. And why not? This is what they did every night. This is who they were. This was the choice they'd all made. He used the washcloth to attempt to remove the remnants of dinner from his son's face as Christopher squirmed and whined his disapproval. Jency watched the domestic scene silently, and Everett wondered what she was thinking. Satisfied with his cleaning job, the rest would come off in the bath, Everett released the booster seat tray and helped him down. Christopher immediately went to Jency, sidling up to her with a charming grin as he thrust a toy car in her face to impress her. "Like father, like son," he thought, and suppressed a grin of his own. "You're quite the little charmer," Jency said, and pulled Christopher onto her lap. Bright turned around and looked at the three of them there at the table, the boy in Jency's lap, Everett sitting beside them. He could only wonder what Jency's thoughts were, but he could take one look at his wife to know what hers were. He caught her eye and winked.
"I love you. You're my wife. This is our son. I wouldn't want it any different."
Bright smiled and turned back to the dishes.
"So where's the little girl now?"
he asked, circling back to the most innocuous topic of conversation he could find. It was awful of him, but he was actually glad for the scene at the pool today. It had given them all something to talk about, allowed them to detour away from the landmines that lay in any other conversational territory.
"Well, she's with Zell. Remember Mrs. Boyette, JJ's mom?"
Bright started loading the dishwasher, speaking without turning around. Everett laughed, thinking of big, lumbering JJ Boyette, the quintessential jock. Everett hadn't thought about him in years.
"Yeah,"
he said, thinking of the time JJ had chased him and his friends through the woods by the lake. People said those woods were haunted, and as a child he'd been terrified of going into them. Later, he'd come to love those woods. He forced himself not to look over at Jency, not to think of their hideaway. At some point, he wanted to talk to her alone, to make sure she wasn't ever going to mention anything to Bright, who still had no idea what had happened in New York. He couldn't afford for anything to knock them off course, not when he'd laid so much groundwork for attempting a second child. Bright would use any excuse to postpone another round of fertility treatments. He understood. Last time was hell. But he also knew that in the end the treatments had worked. He glanced over at Christopher, whose eyes were growing heavy as he sat on Jency's lap. He didn't want his boy to be an only child. He'd been an only child. His world had been lonely until Jency and Bright had come into his life when he moved to Sycamore Glen at 10 years old. He'd thought of them like sisters, until he didn't.
"Have you heard anything?" Jency piped up. "From Zell?"
Bright shook her head and shut the dishwasher door with a thud, the glasses inside clinking loudly against one another as she did.
"Tell you what, I'll go call her. I've got a neighborhood directory around here somewhere."
She strode out of the room, leaving Jency and Everett alone.
"I'm sorry."
Jency waited a moment, then spoke quietly, knowing they had precious few moments alone. "If this is awkward..." He shrugged as if it were no big deal, not letting on how desperate he'd been to cover his bases, to beg her not to mention anything that could damage his marriage. And yet, with Jency sitting there, he didn't want to bring up that awkward and embarrassing night. From the back bedroom they used as an office, he heard Bright using her telephone voice, slightly louder and more formal than her normal speaking voice.
It's just weird, he brought himself to say. Seeing you again. He gestured to Christopher. Here. I'll never bring up the past, she said. She looked over at him and their eyes held. I wouldn't do that, she added. He looked away, focusing his gaze on Christopher's face, but he could still feel her eyes on him. Thanks, he mumbled, as relief flooded his body. Bright returned to the room, talking a mile a minute. So, Kaylee is still with Zell, and it looks like she's going to be there for a while. Terrible situation. Cutter has... Hang on, let me make sure I say this right. Acute respiratory distress syndrome. He's in intensive care, and the mom basically can't miss work because she's the sole breadwinner for the family. They're monitoring Cutter for possible brain damage because he was under the water for who knows how long. I'd like to string those lifeguards up for not paying attention, Bright said, her voice growing more animated. I told you, didn't I, honey? She didn't wait for an assent from him before continuing. I told you how those lifeguards are not doing their jobs. I hope they fire every one of them. I mean, what would have happened if Lance didn't see him and jump in? I shudder to think, Jency agreed, nodding vigorously. She took another gulp of wine. Everett noticed she was knocking the wine back, and Bright, ever the hostess, kept her glass filled. He didn't exactly blame Jency. If he didn't have to get up early for work, he'd definitely get hammered. Christopher yawned and reached for him. Come on, buddy, he said, lifting him into the air as he stood and settled him on his hip. Let's get you into the tub. Oh, let me get him some clean PJs, Bright piped up, scuttling back out of the room. It looks good on you, Jency said to him before he could follow his wife. He turned back to her. What does? He asked. She held her hands out to indicate the room, the house, the wife, the child. All of it, Ev. He nodded his understanding, then quickly walked away. Right. She'd had to walk away from the two of them. She'd seen it. Of course she had. The way he couldn't look at Jency for very long. The way he snuck glances at her when he thought no one noticed. She'd spent her formative years studying Everett Lewis with the devotion of a scholar. She knew his mannerisms by heart. His face spoke as loudly as his voice. He still thought Jency was beautiful. Bright couldn't blame him. She did, too. And the truth was, she somehow wanted to see them together, wanted to subject herself to the pain of it, as if that would make them even. But she hadn't anticipated the intensity of her own pain. The idea of punishing herself had been appealing in concept, but the reality of it was too much to be contained in their small kitchen, amid the scraps of the dinner she'd cooked, the scent of barbecue chicken mingling with Dawn dishwashing liquid. She'd run from the room, landing on the first excuse that came to mind. She ran straight to the drawer that, yes, contained the neighborhood directory to look up Zell's number, but it also contained stray business cards. She'd added that business card to the rest years ago, hidden it in plain sight. As she left Jency and Everett alone in the kitchen to say whatever it was they needed to say without her around, it was that card, and not the neighborhood directory, she had in mind. She tugged open the drawer and removed the directory first, just in case Everett followed her back there. But he wouldn't. He would take the opportunity she'd given him. She rummaged through the haphazard pile, rifling through cards from the electrician and the plumber and the babysitter and, inexplicably, a baby diaper service when she'd never used anything but disposables. She kept sorting through the cards, hearing the murmur of voices in the next room. She refused to think about what they might be saying. They had their secrets, and she had hers. Her hand fell on the card she was there to find, and the pace of her heart picked up as she eyed the familiar lettering, the swirl and curve of the name printed on it. Trent Miller. She could picture his face as he handed it to her. Promise me you'll call if you're ever in the market for a different position, he'd said. Someone like you I could place 1,000 times over for about 1,000 times more money than you're making now. He'd given her that cocky, confident look. She'd gone to take the card from his hand, and he'd pulled it away, teasing her. Promise me, he'd intoned, holding the card out of reach. She'd promised, never thinking that would be the case. She was happy in the job she had at the time and wasn't in the market to be recruited elsewhere. She cared about her clients, and they cared about her. She could solve the technical issues while relating to the human ones, making her invaluable in a field where people usually had one skill or the other, but not both. In fact, it was at the specific request of a former client that her name had come back up again, causing her employer to come knocking. She thought of the emails waiting in her inbox from her old boss and coworker. And yet, maybe Trent knew of other, better opportunities. Could he offer options she hadn't thought of that would give her more leverage now? Would it be the worst thing for her to call him? She ran her fingers across the card and waited for her heart to slow. Then she pocketed it and picked up the neighborhood directory, flipping expertly to the listing for Boyette, John, and Zell. Their children were still listed under their names, though none of them lived with them anymore. Bright found that a little sad. She dialed the number, thinking as she did of Zell's second son, Ty. She had kissed him once, in the woods behind the lake, near the little circle of trees that Jency and Everett used to disappear into. She'd kissed Ty because she was bored, because he was there, and because she was determined to get over Everett. She listened to the sound of Zell's phone ringing in the house two streets over from hers, thinking that no kiss had ever been powerful enough to break the spell Everett had over her. No desire had ever been as strong as the one she had to make him hers. She traced the outline of the card in her pocket. She'd made him hers. Now she just had to keep him. But Jency wasn't the threat anymore. She'd become that all by herself. Kaylee. 3 days went by. I told my mom I would just stay with Zell since she offered, and it was better than being at home alone all the time since Mom was always working or going to the hospital to be with Cutter. It wasn't so bad being with Zell, except for how she kept talking to people on the phone about Cutter. She went into another room and lowered her voice, but I could make out enough to know that, one, this was just about the most exciting thing that had happened to her in a long time, and, two, Cutter was not doing so well. But you know what she would say to me? She would say, he's doing just fine and I should be able to see him soon. I hate when adults lie to kids. I wanted to see Cutter, even if he was out cold and hooked up to a lot of tubes and machines. I wanted to see my mom. I wanted to get it over with, the look she was going to give me, that one of utter disappointment that made me wish she'd just yell at me already. I wanted her to say out loud that I'd ruined everything, and that I might have cost her job and the house we rented and who knew what else. I talked to her on the phone twice, but both times it was really fast and she wasn't going to get into it with Zell hovering nearby anyway. My day of reckoning would come later, and the thought of it made my stomach hurt. Zell tried to occupy my time so I wouldn't think about Cutter and how awful everything was. She had me help her in the kitchen, and tried to teach me how to play cards and took me to the library to check out books on her library card. I told her I might lose the books, and she said, well then, she'd just pay for them if that happened, but she didn't think it would. I was glad she got me the books. It gave me a reason to go to my room, which was really her son's room, and be by myself. But if I stayed in there too long, she knocked on the door and asked me if I was okay, and wouldn't I like something to drink or eat? She was always trying to feed me. I guess if I had to stay somewhere, it wasn't the worst place I could have ended up, even if she did put me in a room that smelled like boy. Zell was nice, if a bit peculiar. I like that word. And her husband, John, was funny. We ate dinner together, the three of us at the table talking about the news and the weather and the things I always imagined families talked about around the table. And for just a moment, I would imagine that it would stay that way forever, that I could change into someone else completely. Someone who grew up in a house like that one, and not the eyesore of the neighborhood. But then I would feel terrible for thinking about myself, especially considering the fact that Cutter got hurt because I was only thinking about myself. In those moments, I would whisper, I'm sorry, and imagine that wherever Cutter was, he could hear me. Late at night when Zell and John thought I'd gone to sleep, I would tiptoe to the window in their son's room and stare up at the stars in the sky, wishing on every one of them just for good measure.
and every wish I had was for Cutter to be okay. I thought only of him, and not me, forcing my brain not to think about the coming school year, or the friends I didn't have, or whether I'd ever fit anywhere. I promised whoever made those stars that if Cutter got better, I'd never care about anyone but him for the rest of my life. And mostly, I believed it was possible.
Zell. She'd hauled a stool out to the garden to get some weeding done, and was awkwardly crouched on it, ripping weeds out down to the roots, an activity she found quite therapeutic, when she heard footsteps approaching. Before this summer, the footsteps would have been heavier, those of John plodding out, wondering what was for dinner or asking where was such and such, even though he'd lived in that house the last 30 years. But it wasn't John. These footsteps were too light to be his, little fairy footsteps. She turned to greet Kaylee, whose presence was fast becoming a fixture. John had warned her just last night not to get too attached. She'd turned from him, busying herself with stirring the beans until he gave up and walked away. It was good to have someone to take care of, someone to cook for. Last night she'd made a big meal, the kind her mama used to make. Country-style steak, mashed potatoes and gravy, fresh corn, green beans, and sliced tomatoes. She'd even made biscuits, something she hadn't done in a coon's age. Kaylee loved her cooking, and ate like there was no tomorrow. Zell worried that the child hadn't been fed properly, and made it her mission to get some nourishment in her. For dessert, she'd made real banana pudding, only to learn that Kaylee didn't like bananas. But that was okay, because she had some ice cream in the freezer, and John was only too happy to eat the banana pudding himself, though Lord knew he didn't need it. She glanced down at her own belly, brimming over the top of her waistband, then looked up and gave Kaylee a smile. She adjusted her wide-brimmed straw hat so she could see the child better. "Have a good sleep?" she asked her. Kaylee nodded, chewing her lip and casting her eyes about like she was casing the joint. "Give me just a minute to finish up here, and I'll make you some breakfast." Zell turned back to the weeds, wincing as her knee protested the movement. The stool wasn't really helping. She missed being able to kneel, missed getting her nose and hands fully immersed in the earth.
"I could help you with that, if you want," Kaylee offered.
She moved closer, coming into Zell's line of sight.
"Do you know about gardening?"
Zell asked, unable to keep the surprise from her voice. Kaylee shrugged.
"I helped my teacher at my old school. We were making a wildlife habitat. It was a class project, but I moved away before we finished."
Kaylee thought about it for a second.
That was 2 schools ago.
She shrugged as if it meant nothing, but Zell could see the lie in her pensive little face. She heard John's warning again about getting attached, his words echoing from the night before. He knew her all too well.
"But you liked it?"
Kaylee nodded.
"I liked making a place for, you know, the animals and such. We planted special plants they could eat and made places for them to hide."
She shrugged again. "It was pretty cool." Zell's voice was tight when she spoke, and she cleared her throat.
"I bet you'd wished you'd seen it all finished."
Kaylee nodded, her eyes focused on the landscape. She blinked a few times.
"Yeah, my mom said we could go back one day, but she never has time."
"Is the school nearby?" Zell asked.
Kaylee thought about it.
"I think it's like an hour away. Maybe."
"Ah," said Zell.
She thought about her own life with young children, how overwhelming things had seemed then, and she'd been a stay-at-home mom with no outside responsibilities. There were so many things she'd intended to do with them, for them, but the time got away and then it was over.
"I'm sure your mom would love to take you sometime."
"Yeah," Kaylee agreed. "I know she would if she could."
She glanced over at Zell. "She's a good mom."
"She sure is, honey."
Zell had noticed Kaylee's penchant for defending her mom, even though no charges had been levied against her. The woman, Lisa, was clearly in over her head, cursed with more responsibility than she had resources to handle, exacerbated, Zell guessed, from things that Kaylee had said, by a tendency to pick cruel, freeloading men. Zell had seen it before. Her own sister, for example, was now living in Arkansas with husband number 4. She wasn't judging Kaylee's mom. At least she hoped it didn't come across that she was. She was just trying to help. Somewhere deep inside her, a warning bell went off, but she ignored it. "Can I go see her?" Kaylee asked, seeming to sense a weak moment, an opportune time to strike. Kids, Zell recalled, were exceedingly good at that.
"I want to go see her and cut her."
Zell had spoken with Lisa just yesterday when she'd stopped by to see Kaylee. Cutter was still touch and go. He was hanging in there, but not improving as they'd hoped. Lisa and Zell had agreed that it was best for Kaylee not to see Cutter until he was awake. That was exactly how they'd put it, stringing the words "until" and "awake" together in an act of good faith, both of them wanting to believe that this kind of positive talk could make all the difference. Zell had said a little prayer for the boy after Lisa left, even though she wasn't in a position to be asking for favors from the Almighty.
"Soon, honey," Zell promised. "I'm waiting for your mother to let me know that the doctors have cleared Cutter for visitors."
When all else fails, blame it on the doctors. This was also something she remembered from raising her own children. "The doctor said you have to eat that. The doctor said you have to go to bed now. The doctor said you have to have sunscreen or you can't go swimming." The doctor was always a good scapegoat. Zell held her breath and hoped her ploy would work on Kaylee like it did with her own kids.
"I wish those doctors would hurry up,"
Kaylee grumbled, sinking down beside Zell on the lawn.
"What if..."
Zell spoke aloud, her mouth uttering the words even before the idea had fully taken shape. Kaylee looked up, her face expectant, eager. Like most children, she knew that questions that started off with "what if" were usually good questions.
"What if," Zell continued, "you and I turn my yard into a wildlife habitat? It could be our little project while you're here."
She watched Kaylee's reaction, hoped this wasn't a colossal mistake. Something inside her said, "You never learn." But something else said, "Maybe this time will be different." Kaylee hesitated for just a moment, as if she were having an internal dialogue of her own. But then the eager, expectant look returned, and a grin broke out across her little face. Kaylee's genuine smiles were rare, and Zell let herself take this one in, because this one was just for her.
"Yes?"
she prompted, wanting to hear the word on Kaylee's lips. Kaylee nodded vigorously, and the grin widened.
"Yes,"
she said. She sprang up and started sprinting away, then turned back to beckon Zell to follow her.
"I know the website we have to go to," she hollered from across the yard. "Come on, I'll show you."
Zell smiled and started the slow process of getting herself up off the stool, her knee already protesting with even the slightest movement. In a flash, Kaylee was back at her side.
"Here,"
she said, extending her small hand.
"I'll help you up."
Zell did the only thing there was to do. She took Kaylee's hand and allowed the child to help her stand. Right. She sank down onto the cold tile of the laundry room floor and willed herself to get a grip. She'd found the business card in the pocket of her shorts, rescued seconds before being thrown into the washing machine and destroyed by the hot water she was about to send pouring into the tub. Her heart pounding, she remembered and pinched it out of its hiding place, nestled there between the layers of denim, put there as a protective weapon on a night she'd felt vulnerable. She thought not of Jency's face, but of Everett's as he looked at Jency. She worried that Jency's return had put everything she'd created for herself at risk. As a child, she'd wanted exactly what she'd grown up with. She wanted to replicate the life she'd known. She was the only one of her friends who felt that way, her teen years spent listening to various accounts of how the future was going to be different for them. Jency wanted a big house. Everett wanted Jency. Other friends wanted more religion or less, more freedom or less, more money, but never less. Different politics, different traditions, different lives from the ones they'd been brought up in. She would listen politely, nod when appropriate, and make encouraging comments,
but inside she was thinking, is it wrong to want more of the same?
She loved her parents, her home, her neighborhood, even her school. She loved swimming with the same kids each summer at the pool, the big 4th of July celebration that lasted all day and into the night, the way the sun's rays glinted off the lake and the breeze rippled the water. She loved church on Sundays and takeout pizza on Fridays, the Christmas card photos of friends and family members affixed to the refrigerator door for months after the holidays were over, and afternoons reading in the backyard hammock. She loved belonging to this place and these people. She knew she was lucky. Many kids didn't have what she had. What more was there to want? Crouched on her laundry room floor, running her fingers across the raised black letters, she waffled between remembering and forgetting, between who she was, then and now. She'd gotten exactly what she wanted, but it had come at a price she'd never expected. She stood, feeling restless and anxious, her heart beating much too hard for a stay-at-home mom doing laundry on an ordinary summer Tuesday. She palmed the card and walked it back to its original spot in the drawer. But before she could hide it away again, she paused, taking one last look. She took in the name, then the phone number, then the email. Could it still be the same? Would it hurt to try? She took a deep breath and reached for her cell phone, charging on the desk where she had left it the night before. She gave herself a pep talk as she entered the numbers on the card into her phone's keypad. This was about a job, and that was all. She was doing her due diligence in the face of the repeated requests from her former employer. She was just being smart. Her heart hammered as the line rang and rang and rang. It went to voicemail, and the minute she heard his voice, she hit end, a reflex. This was wrong and dangerous and stupid. She stood there panting as if she'd run a marathon, her insides churning. She paced back and forth a few times in front of the desk, calming herself, still holding her phone. This morning, before he'd left for work, Everett had said he was going to make an appointment at the clinic, but they couldn't keep putting it off. He'd brushed aside her objections, put his hands on her shoulders, and with a serious look, told her that he'd be with her every step of the way. He'd never understand that this was the last thing she wanted. She would do anything to keep from hearing the same verdict, the same options she'd heard before. And going back to work could stop that from happening. She looked down at the phone, debating placing a second call and this time not hanging up. If you do this, she coached herself, everything could change. But everything was going to change anyway. She pulled up her recent calls and hit the number again. She cleared her throat as the phone rang, readying herself to leave a message. There was that voice, strangely familiar, even though it had been years since she'd heard it last. She smiled at the sound of it, then began to speak after the beep. Hi, she said. This is Brad Lewis. We met several years ago at the ATXS show, at the cocktail party. I'm not sure you'll remember, but you mentioned I should call if I was ever looking for a job, and I am. So if you can, I'd love to talk to you about it. I know tomorrow is the 4th, so you're probably not even working this week, but if you can give me a call, my number is... The beep sounded, and she was cut off. A voice inside her said, this isn't just about a job. But she ignored the voice, pushing it into that place deep within her where the truth resided. She watched as the phone's screen returned to a photo of the three of them at Easter, all dressed up. She'd put Christopher and Everett in adorable matching pastel bow ties. She exhaled loudly and considered calling back to leave her number. No. The number would show up in his list of incoming calls. If he wanted to respond, he'd figure it out. July 2014. Jency. The impact of a little body landing on the mattress jolted her awake in her old bedroom, never changed since her departure, a pastel wonderland with its boy band posters and various other accoutrements of the teenage female. Her girls were fascinated with the time capsule that was her old bedroom, holding long-since dried-out bottles of nail polish up to her with a kind of wonder. "Mom," Pilar had asked, astonished, "you wore glitter nail polish?" She supposed it was astonishing to a child who'd only seen her mother with French manicures, which was what all the women had back in her old neighborhood. She'd taken the bottle of nail polish from Pilar's hand and studied it for a moment, seeing in her mind's eye sitting with Bright on her bed, doing one another's nails. Bright was always so careful, so serious about the polish being just so. She'd been fastidious then and, from what Jency could tell, was still that way. She was just as serious and careful in her devotion to her home, her cooking, her son, and Everett. Jency tried not to think about those few moments alone she'd had with Everett after dinner. There were things she'd wanted to say to him, but didn't dare, the unsaid words still rolling around like marbles in her mind. "Get up, Mom!" Zara hollered, shaking the mattress as violently as her small body could manage, her shrill voice too loud and piercing on the cusp of a sound sleep. Jency had been dreaming she was in the woods by the lake, but there was someone else there, too. Someone she didn't know, but who knew her. The presence disturbing, threatening, and all too real. She tried to shake off the dream even as she pulled back the sheets so Zara could snuggle under with her. She hugged her daughter tighter and kissed her head several times, the action warding off any lingering bad mojo from her dreams. Zara giggled and wrenched away. "Mom, we have to get ready for the parade," she scolded. Jency moaned aloud and pulled the covers over her head. "Can't your grandmother take you?" she said from under the sheets. She'd known today was the 4th and had vaguely thought of the neighborhood to-do over the big day, but hadn't actually expected to take part in any of it. Pilar and Zara had spent the day yesterday helping her mother make the traditional dishes to put out at the neighborhood potluck. Things just wouldn't be the same in Sycamore Glen if her mother's potato salad wasn't among the dishes. Jency wasn't in the mood to participate in a large celebration that most likely would involve people she hadn't seen in over a decade, fielding questions about her husband and why she was there, which she'd so far, for the most part, been able to avoid. But the girls were invested now, which meant she was as well. Zara's head appeared underneath the covers, her grin so wide her dimples showed. She scooched down to get into Jency's line of sight. She was her mirror child, her baby, her sweetest girl. "No, Mom, you have to come. You promised." It was true. She'd agreed at dinner last night, acquiescing to the girls' pleas without much of a fight. That would teach her to drink wine at dinner. She tossed the covers back with a world-weary sigh, her eyes falling on a poster of Marky Mark, before he'd become the more respectable Mark Wahlberg. "You're right, I said I would go, so let's go watch this amazing, elaborate display of patriotism," she said, her voice containing so much false enthusiasm she expected Zara to see right through it. But she didn't. "Pilar!" Zara hollered as she hopped up from the bed. "I told you she'd come!" She scampered from the room, her little feet thundering down the hall in search of her sister. If her parents weren't awake, they would be now. "Serves them right," she thought. She was tempted to pull the covers back over her head and fall headlong back into dreamland, but she wasn't sure her dreamland was a safe place to go. She took her spot on the sidewalk with the other neighbors, waiting for the parade to start. Her mother had prepared a thermos of coffee for her, and a friendly man she didn't recognize handed her a donut to go with it. She accepted the fried ring of dough and sugar just because it was the 4th of July, and the donut had red, white, and blue sprinkles. It felt unpatriotic to turn it down. She watched the parade, such as it was, begin its long trek from the entrance of the neighborhood to the clubhouse. As tradition dictated, the local fire department had sent an engine to lead the way, and she waved back at a fireman who hung off the side, pointing at her as he passed, waving enthusiastically when he was sure he had her attention. "I think he likes you," Bright sidled up, pushing Christopher in his stroller. After all their days at the pool together, Jency had come to recognize that stroller as well as she recognized other people's vehicles. Jency grinned at her and said hello even though her mouth was still full of donut. She broke off a bite of donut and handed it to Christopher without asking Bright first. Christopher looked up at her with utter gratitude on his face, stuffing the donut in his mouth before his mother could think better of it and take it away. Bright laughed. Donuts are his love language. Smart boy, Jensie said. She looked around for Everett and was glad when she saw that he wasn't with her. Reading her mind, Bright explained, "We came to see Daddy ride his back, didn't we, Christopher?" She raised her eyebrows and gestured to the pack of paraders still waiting for their turn. A big red tractor decorated with an abundance of streamers putted by. The man driving it spit a big brown stream of tobacco juice onto the pavement. Only in the South, she thought. Beside her, Wright shuddered at the sight of the spit, then continued talking. Everett got roped into riding his bike with some of the other neighborhood guys. She looked down at Christopher, his mouth stuffed with the donut. Christopher helped decorate it last night, she added. I'm sure it's lovely. Bright laughed. It's, colorful, she said with a smile. She looked around. Your girls in the parade? Oh, yes. My parents decorated their golf cart. They'll be along any minute. They stood in companionable silence for a bit as girls on horses and a man in a huge old convertible made their way past. People cheered and clapped and screamed, more for the sheer excuse to do so than because the entries were anything spectacular. Children ran up and down the parade route, shrieking their excitement and waving their arms so the people in the parade would throw them candy. She tried to imagine this sort of spectacle in her old neighborhood, but she might as well have been trying to envision a parade of elephants or spaceships traversing down the main drag of her former residence. For one thing, aliens and pachyderms would never make it past the gatehouse. For another, her old neighbors only did things with elegance, distinction, class. A hodgepodge, anything-goes parade like the one she was watching would have caused horror and dismay among the people she'd once called friends. She felt a little foot nudge her in the back of the leg and looked down to see Christopher kicking absent-mindedly as he took in the sights, his brow knit together, his face serious. She tried not to think too much about whether he looked like Everett. He was all decked out in red, white, and blue, as were most of the other kids. Her own girls had cobbled together white T-shirts and denim shorts at the last minute, and her mother had come to the rescue with red and white polka-dot ribbons for their ponytails, completing their patriotic ensembles. In her old neighborhood, she'd have planned weeks in advance, ordered special coordinated, heaven forbid they matched, outfits for them to wear. This year she hadn't given it a second thought. A man on a unicycle rolled by them, throwing candy out of a fanny pack as he went. Bright caught a piece of gum, unwrapped it, and handed it to Christopher, who looked like he'd hit the jackpot as he greedily stuffed it into his mouth. "Do you remember doing this as kids?" Bright asked when she turned back toward the action. Everett still hadn't been by. "Oh, sure," Jensie said, as if it was old hat, unwilling to admit all the memories the event was stirring in here. So many memories she faced each day, all coming at her like a mental assault. Her parents came by in the golf cart with Pilar and Zara waving shyly from the back seat as they passed. Jensie attempted to wolf whistle and saw Pilar duck her head in embarrassment, her face taking on a rosy blush. Zara hollered, "Mom! Hey, Mom!" and waved more furiously. Jensie laughed and waved back just as furiously. Zara's ribbon had come untied on one pigtail, and the other was hanging in there, giving her a lopsided look. She spotted the man, the one who'd saved the little boy, heading toward them, a meek and uncertain smile on his face. The unlikely hero who'd teased her about being named after a legendary one. She gave him a little wave. He looked momentarily surprised, then waved back and headed their way with a little more confidence in his step. He stopped when he got to them. "Hello," he greeted them. "I was hoping I'd see you guys there."
"Wouldn't miss it," Bright said.
He waited until he caught Jensie's eye. "Hi," he said, and it felt like a special greeting just for her. She blushed in spite of herself. "How are you?" she asked. She hadn't seen him since the incident and hoped he was doing okay after what had happened. She hadn't been able to get it too far from her mind, and she hadn't been the one to pull the child out of that pool. She'd heard Cutter was not out of the woods. He shrugged. Hanging in there. He gestured at the paraders going by. Just celebrating our nation's birth. She grinned in response. Well, you've come to the right place. She knew all their minds had to be on what they'd witnessed, in spite of the forced celebration. It was the only reason she wanted to go to the pool today, to be around the people who'd been there that day. Do you come every year? She asked, just to keep the conversation going. Yeah, my wife, Deborah, she loved all this stuff. So the kids think it's a requirement to come. He rolled his eyes, and she could sympathize with his reticence to be somewhere people were having a good time. It took a lot out of you, celebrating when you wanted to do anything but. I'm sorry for your loss, she said. He looked at her and squinted his eyes in confusion. Loss? Your wife? She's, deceased? She winced at her words. First she brought up the little boy, then his wife's death. Way to keep things positive. She was definitely rusty at conversing with the opposite sex. Thankfully, he didn't look upset. Instead, he surprised her by laughing. Deborah? Dead? He shook his head. I might have wished her dead sometimes, but no, she's very much alive. We're just living apart while she figures out what she wants out of life. He made air quotes with his fingers as he said the last part, his voice dripping with sarcasm. He gave her a meaningful look. Turns out she's not so sure she ever wanted any of this life, after all. He gave her a what-are-you-gonna-do shrug, just as Bright broke into whoops and applause, startling them both. Jency turned in time to see Everett ride by on a mountain bike, bedecked in streamers and paper flags. He was wearing an Uncle Sam top hat, which he tipped in Bright and Christopher's direction. See, Daddy? Bright yelled and pointed, as if Christopher could miss him. From his stroller, his somber expression had changed, and he also began waving and hollering. When he smiled, dimples creased his cheeks and his eyes danced. He clapped his hands together, marveling at the sight of his dad. Jency clapped as well. When her eyes locked with Everett's, she smiled at him. He didn't tip his hat to her, and she didn't expect him to. He belonged to someone else now. He rode past her, but she didn't watch him go. Kaylee. I didn't want to go back to the pool ever again, but Zell said I had to. She said the 4th of July was going to be fun and told me all about the stuff they do, which I thought sounded lame. But I wasn't going to tell her that, seeing as how she was giving me a place to stay. She gave me a pep talk about conquering my fears and how I couldn't avoid water for the rest of my life. She said that the longer I waited, the harder it was going to be, and the more I was going to let the fear own me. She said that part of growing up is facing your fears and doing the things you didn't want to do. Then she got a funny look on her face, like maybe her knee was bothering her. It bothered her a lot, but whenever I told her she should go to the doctor, she just shook her head. Are you okay? I asked her. Oh, sure, she said and made her face look right again. Now, go get your bathing suit on. Before I went upstairs, I said, Zell? And she said, Hmm? But she sounded like she was thinking about something else. And I said, You don't make growing up sound like all that much fun. Then she laughed and said, Well, honey, sometimes it's not. Then she shooed me upstairs. As I got dressed, I thought about things we'd done on other July 4th. We'd never really made a big deal out of it. Usually my mother had to work. Sometimes at night she and whoever her boyfriend was at the time would take us to see fireworks, sitting on the hood of the warm car. Her boyfriends always said the same thing to her, as if they were the first ones to ever think of it. Later, we'll make fireworks of our own. And she always laughed like it was the first time she'd ever heard it. Once, we went to a family picnic, back when my mother was still speaking to her family. We ate hot dogs and hamburgers that my mom's dad cooked on the grill, and my mom's stepmom, a woman she insisted was evil but seemed nice enough to me. She made apple pie for dessert.
We ate big, warm slices with rivers of vanilla ice cream melting into the crust. The pie made me feel good inside, warm and full and happy. Then my mom said her stepmom probably made those pies from poison apples, and I spent the rest of the night thinking of Snow White eating the poison apple and sleeping for years. I was afraid to go to sleep that night. Instead, I lay in my bed and looked up at the ceiling, replaying the fireworks we'd seen, trying to recall the patterns of color they'd traced across the night sky. Cutter had been scared of the fireworks, hiding his eyes. I tried not to think of Cutter, how he was missing the 4th of July this year and how much he would have wanted to be there. No matter what Zell said, I didn't want to go back to that pool, to see the spot under the water where Mr. Lance had found him, to watch other kids have fun and worry that Cutter would never get a chance to have fun like that again, to watch the fireworks over the lake and know he wasn't scared of them at all because he couldn't see them, and to know that it was all my fault. Lance hated the pool on the 4th of July. People came out of the woodwork, jostling for space in the water, taking up all the available chairs, and generally causing mayhem in a place that was normally quiet and restful. Deborah had dragged the family there year after year after they'd moved into the neighborhood. She'd marveled over how quaint it all was, delighting in the old-fashioned traditions, the pie-eating competition, the greased watermelon contest, the coin and egg tosses, the prayer before the potluck dinner, everyone's heads bowed in unison. "This is all just so Southern," she'd gushed happily. He'd gone along with it, but he hadn't been happy about it, and he'd let her know it. When she left, she'd called him passive-aggressive. She'd silently stored up his transgressions throughout their marriage, then spewed them at him all at once, a human hydrant. So it was ironic that this year of all years, he actually wanted to be there. Without Deborah there to drag him, he went of his own accord, hustling the kids up there as soon as the parade was over, in an effort to secure a good spot. He'd even saved a chair for Jency, having promised to do so when they'd parted ways after the parade. Shy as a schoolboy, he'd asked her if she was planning to come up to the pool for the festivities. She'd shrugged nonchalantly and said, "Not much else to do." "Come on," he'd said and elbowed her. "It'll be fun." And when he did it, he thought of Deborah doing and saying the very same thing on previous July 4ths. In that moment, a shock traveled through him. The shock of Deborah being right. It wasn't the first time it had happened since she'd left. There were many times since she'd gone that he'd been struck by the evidence that all those things she'd said just might have been true. If he knew where she was, he would say he was sorry. But Deborah had gone into hiding, and he'd given up trying to find her. Her sister had assured him that she was safe, and that was all he needed to know. Deborah wanted to be gone, and she would stay that way until she didn't want to be gone anymore. He understood this more with each passing day, and hated her less the more he understood. He even respected her just the tiniest bit for having the courage to go. He sprayed the children with sunscreen as they wiggled and complained, then released them to play. He tried his best not to look over at the deep end of the pool, where he'd found the still form of the boy under the water. From the look of things, the pool management company had stepped up their lifeguard presence and done some serious training on vigilance since the near drowning. The lifeguards sat alert and attentive in their high chairs, surveying the crowds with whistles around their necks and flotation devices at the ready in their laps. Their postures were that of attack dogs barely restrained on leashes. "Good," he thought. He tried to relax, trusting his services would not be needed again. Every hour on the hour, a new contest took place with James Doyle, a neighborhood fixture, officiating. Known for his devotion to his elderly mother and mentally delayed brother, he was particularly invested in the 4th of July celebration. He used personal money to buy the fireworks for the neighborhood show and made sure that there were plenty of eggs for the egg toss and snack cakes for the pie-eating contest. He kept everything on schedule and even purchased trophies for the winners of the various contests. Everyone seemed to appreciate his efforts to keep the tradition going, because the truth was,
No one else would if he didn't. Lance caught James's eye and gave him a friendly wave, as he always did. They were neighbors, but Lance had never made an effort to do much more than wave at him from a distance, across their respective yards. It wasn't like they had anything in common. Sure, he felt sorry for the guy, who'd certainly gotten a raw deal in life, and he respected him because he seemed to make the best of things in spite of it. But he left it there, which was admittedly not the most neighborly way to be. A volleyball game of middle-aged men formed in one of the pools, and he turned his attention to it, idly taking in the action more as a way to keep his attention off the empty chair beside him. He tried not to care about Jency showing up, but more than once he'd turned someone away who wanted it, if you're not using it. He felt the slightest bit selfish, taking up a perfectly good chair that others could use in the hopes that Jency would show. But then he would think of seeing her that morning, and how he hadn't been that glad to see someone in a long, long time. "I'm sorry," he said again and again. "I'm saving this one for someone." The first game ended, and the men all climbed out of the pool to swig beer and trade barbs, their guffaws echoing even over the noise and hubbub of the crowd, calling to him, or at least to part of him. He supposed he could join them, if he was so inclined. He had, after all, fallen into the category of middle-aged man, a fact that still surprised him. He heard a female voice say, "Is this seat taken?" and turned his head in the direction of the voice, but it wasn't Jency. He frowned, explained yet again that he was saving the chair, then pulled the cooler from underneath the umbrella where he'd stowed it, and added it to the towels and beach bag that were already marking the chaise as taken, in hopes it would make it more obvious. If she didn't show up soon, he'd have to surrender the chaise. And maybe that would be for the best. He was, after all, technically a married man. And judging from the rock she wore on her left ring finger, she was a married woman. He suspected they each had stories to tell about missteps and miscommunication, about regret and resignation. He wanted to hear her story, and reasoned there could be no harm in that. They could be friends. He scanned the perimeter of the pool until he accounted for each of his children. Alec was by himself, as usual, and Lila was sitting beside Kaylee, eating grapes with her. Lila had become fiercely loyal to the poor girl, and Lance hoped that spoke of his daughter's character. They were sitting next to Zell, who waved at him so demonstratively her visor nearly came off her head. He gave her a polite wave in return, and turned back to watch the game. But the men, while back in the water, were still horsing around, swigging more beer, and leering at the women, girls really, who'd congregated nearby. On the end closest to where he sat, a heavy-set, balding old man he'd seen before shuffled to the opposite end of the pool and, in spite of the crowds, made a motion for the lap lane to be cleared. Lance leaned forward, anticipating the response of the volleyball players. They weren't going to like the old man making them move their game over. Lance was drawn into the drama, such as it was. The rest of the men moved over good-naturedly, but one stood his ground, his barrel chest puffed up, a beer gripped tightly in his hand. He was wearing, ridiculously, a red, white, and blue bandana in his hair, a youthful look he wasn't able to pull off. One of the guys tried to pull him out of the lane, saying something to him that Lance couldn't hear. The man shrugged his friend off and stayed put, his chin jutting out as he waited for the old man to swim the length of the pool and reach him. When the man got closer, Bandana Man began yelling at him, his face red and his language definitely not appropriate for a family gathering. One of his buddies attempted to stop him again, and his attempt was met with a forceful shove. "I just want to know why this asshole has to come up here today of all days," he gestured with his arm at the crowd. "I mean, look at this place, man. He shouldn't have to take up a lane on the fucking 4th of July." With Bandana Man distracted by the exchange, the old man saw his opportunity and veered around him in order to make it to the wall. Lance couldn't imagine why it mattered so much that he make it all the way across the length of the pool. He suspected it was tangled up in his pride, which was understandable. But the old man was too large to just slip by, and Bandana Man, alerted by the churning water, turned back and jumped into his path, colliding with him. What happened next brought Lance to his feet and stilled the entire pool as all attention turned toward the drama in the shallow end.